This is episode 190, recorded December 16th, 2013.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Hi, guys.
We've got lots and lots of contributors today.
Which is great.
It is indeed. Mm-hmm. Who have we got lined up?
We have Anthony in Monmouth, Oregon, Mick in Carnforth, and Tony, New York, and Scott in Texas, Sean in Asheville, North Carolina, and Dr. Bob on the North Shore of Boston.
Oh, you know what? And I didn't get it into the top list, but Tom in Provo also.
Oh, Tom in Provo!
Yep.
That also.
Okay, so, yes. That was a recent one. It just came a couple of hours ago.
I didn't get it in the notes yet.
The top list, but it is on the queue.
Okay. Shall we just dive in, or do you have anything you want to talk about first?
Let's just dive in.
Okay, here we go. Splash! We'll start with Anthony.
Okay, I take it back.
Oh.
Sorry. I just wanted...
You're so naughty!
I know. I was just looking at it and figuring stuff out. Mick.
Yes?
He made a donation to the Aquarimax Fund.
Oh, yes, he did. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mick. We appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very happy to receive the donations that we're going to put right back into Aquarimax, make Aquarimax a lovelier place to be.
Okay. Now should I go to Anthony?
Yes.
Okay. He says, good day to all Aquarimaxers. I have finally caught up with some podcasts and have heard the discussion on a 300-watt heater versus two 150-watt heaters for power savings. I have recently been reading my hobby magazines, and with it being winter this side of the globe, heaters are a big discussion matter. They have mentioned that two 150s are better than one 300 because you can put them in different sides and get a more even heating. With this thought, it would be more efficient than one heater. Also, there's the added benefit of one heater functional at all times, allowing for emergency heat so the tank won't crash if one heater goes out, which I think we did talk about some of those things.
We probably have at some point, but it's good to keep those in mind. So thank you, Anthony, for
reminding us. Oh, I didn't mean he shouldn't have said them. I was just trying to remember the discussion.
Right. No, that's fine. And another thing is that it also helps if you have one heater that gets stuck on as opposed to off.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to have a 150-watt heater stuck on
than a 300-watt.
300-watt stuck on.
And it was... what did he decide to do? I don't remember if he got...
I think that is what he did.
He got two?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, so thank you, Anthony.
Mm-hmm. Have we heard from Anthony before?
Yes, we have.
Okay.
A number of times.
Okay. Now we're going to go to Tony.
In New York.
Yes, not to be confused with Anthony, even though the names are related. Okay. He says, happy holidays, Aquarimaxers everywhere, and Merry Christmas, Russ Kelly and family. Thank you very much.
Merry Christmas to you, too.
And he says, so, first off, thanks, Mick, for the link to the polyfilter. They have this at my local fish store, so I'm going to pick it up soon. Russ, as you have suggested, I have added a nice air pump with two air stones to my 6.6-gallon formerly shrimp tank. I am no longer seeing the scum after being diligent these past couple of weeks. The tank currently has two nerite snails in it. I've heard that Java moss is tolerant of salt, and so my first idea for the tank is to turn it into a brackish tank and find out if the zebra nerites will breed. They lay eggs all the time. Wouldn't it be cool if they started hatching?
That would be cool.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some questions relating to that, right?
Yes, he does. He says, questions for scenario one. If I want to go brackish, can I use freshwater salt? Or should I use the marine salt? Do you know how much I should use? I don't plan to turn the tank into a marine aquarium yet. I want to see if I can do a tank that suits grown-ups, offspring, and the Java moss. Also, it is probably the perfect time to try this.
Okay. Let me tell you some things.
What? I read that and I had a funny image in my head and I was trying to think, why are nerite snails more appropriate to grown-ups than to kids? But then I realized he meant grown-up snails and juvenile snails, not people.
Right. Okay.
I see this snail tank with like a, you know, NC-17 across it or something. Like, I don't get it.
Okay. Well... olive nerites are pretty close to zebra nerites, and I've had olive nerites hatch in my brackish tanks. So I can give you some... I only have one zebra nerite, and I've only ever had one zebra nerite, but olive nerites are pretty close in most respects, so hopefully this information will be Applicable. Let me tell you, I would use marine salt for several reasons. But one is it's going to be a lot more natural, a mix of minerals and whatnot. So it's more likely to be healthy for the snails, but also pH is going to be a factor there. Normal marine salt buffers pH. It does, just normal freshwater aquarium salt doesn't.
I have a question. What is freshwater salt? Because isn't that kind of an oxymoron?
Well, he's just abbreviating freshwater aquarium salt. So they'll often use salt that is manufactured specifically for use with aquariums. It doesn't have like the iodine or the sodium silicate or whatever those things they add to it to keep it, the anti-caking agents that we use
In
for
table
table
salt.
salt and the iodine and things like that.
But what is it for? What, if marine salt's better for brackish tanks, what do they make the freshwater salt for? For
There are
treating
several
sick
things, but
fish
usually for
or?
treating diseases, that sort of thing,
Okay.
for cleaning certain things, that sort of thing.
But
So,
not so much for
not
making
for making
water.
brackish mix,
Okay.
right? Although some people have used it for that, but in general, for long-term health of fish and invertebrates, the marine salt is much better.
Okay.
I would say you want to get the salinity somewhere between 25 and 50% of ocean water. That's where I had my Opaula tanks at when the olive neurites hatched. I haven't had any hatch for a while, and I'm not sure why that is, if it's because the one that I had put in the tank originally was a female that had already made it, and then I haven't had the right combination of males and females in that tank or whatever. I'm not sure what it is. But I had lots and lots of them hatch. Probably hundreds and hundreds. And none of them survived.
What happened to them all? How big were they when they died?
Oh, they're quite tiny. They hadn't settled out, and they were still in the planktonic stage. Because nerites become, they don't go straight from snail to snail, like, most snails you think of go from, they hatch out of the egg and they're a tiny snail with a shell that crawls around.
Okay.
Nerites and many other, actually, marine snails don't do that. They become villagers. Not to be confused with
Villagers?
villagers.
As
It's,
in pillage the villagers?
it's pronounced quite differently. Villagers.
Villagers. Oh, yes, that's worlds of
And it's
difference.
spelled
With an
even more
E?
differently. It's Velliger. Villager.
Villager.
Yeah. And it is, like I said, it's kind of planktonic. It just floats around in the water column.
Okay.
And it
So yours didn't make it
does
past
that
that
for a
stage?
while, and then it will settle out and become a snail if all goes well. But in my Opaula tanks, which are quite low tech, I think there were several things going against them that made them not survive. I think one of them is it probably needed a little bit more aeration, because I usually don't have aeration in my Opaula tanks. I think another factor was that they need a lot of suspended microalgae in the water to eat. That's my understanding, at least. And there
And there
wasn't
isn't
much.
in the because the Opayula were already eating it,
Opaula,
or
they eat everything, so there wasn't that much in the water, I don't think. Not enough for them to be happy anyway. And the Opaula were probably eating them too. So, just about anything that can eat them will eat them, and they're quite small.
So do you need them to have them in their own setup to breed them, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can keep them with the adults of their own species, but you the I've read a few like pages, forums, posts on them breeding them. Some people do have success, but I think usually when they do, they keep them in brackish or even full strength seawater. They have a lot of microalgae growing in the tank. They have a low current. And they don't have any sort of filter that could suck them out of the water and kill them. Like, a power filter is a no-no.
Right.
They might have a sponge filter, maybe, or just an airstone.
Okay.
And those seem to be the conditions that you'd need. So, if you're willing to look into doing that, then maybe that's the way to go, Tony. I mean, you could try that. Now, the Java moss, at 25% salinity, I'm not sure how it would do it. At 50%, it'd be a little tricky. But I've added, aquarium salt to tanks with Java moss to get rid of hydra. I remember a long time ago doing that. The Java moss seemed fine. But other times when I've tried to, and then I, change that out after a week or two, and the Java Moss was fine, seemed completely unaffected. But how about other times when I've put Java Moss into an Opaila tank, only to see it not do very well, and usually die. So I don't know if it's just... Java Moss is certainly more tolerant to salt than a lot of other plants are. And it certainly won't grow in full-strength seawater either. But, you know, that would be worth some experimentations.
Okay.
And, yeah, I would say, though, to make sure you get the mixture of salt right, I'd use the hygrometer. You know, make sure you get one of those to measure the salt, the salinity in the water. And depending on the mix, but if you use, like, Instant Ocean, I think it's half a cup per gallon about. So you use an eighth of a cup to a gallon. And, of course, don't add the salt powder directly to your aquarium.
You mix it up in different things?
Get a gallon of water, add the salt to it, and either aerate it or use a like a powerhead-type pump to mix it up thoroughly for about 24 hours before you do it.
Until it's all dissolved?
And then do a water change where you take 1 gallon out and put 1 gallon in. Okay. And then you top that off during the week so that you're not concentrating the salt. And then do another water change like that. And then just keep monitoring your...
Wow. Sorry, NASA is calling us NASA for just a second.
Because there's a full moon tomorrow. That's why.
Oh, yes. They fun. Like to let us know.
Sorry. We're just going to leave that in. I hope you don't mind, because editing that out is going to be a nightmare. So, I would say that it's worth...
When you top it off, you top it off with the pre-made salt water, or you top it off with fresh water?
No, you top it off with fresh water, but then you do a water change with the salt water. And then just keep monitoring your salinity, and you can get it up to 25% that way. And that would probably be good enough for the babies to survive if they're going to survive. I mean, if everything else is okay for them.
Okay, he has another idea, too, in case he decides not to do the nerites. He says, my next idea, guppies and ghost shrimp. I'd love to try guppies and ghost shrimp in this 6.6. Maybe with the bubbler, I could really get a good colony of guppies going. My inspiration is that maybe the ghost shrimp would go after the fry and keep numbers down. I'm not really sure how this would work out. Some say that ghost shrimp will predate?
Yeah.
Not predate.
Prey upon.
Well, I know what it means. I just didn't know if I was saying it right.
No, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Predate on the adults too, or maybe the ghost shrimp would only eat ailing guppies and fry. How do you think the ghost shrimp would behave in this sort of environment? And am I crazy to try guppies in such a small tank, since there might soon be 100 in there?
Sorry, fine tuning here of our equipment. All right. Well, you could do guppies in that tank. I know that some people recommend, like the Bailey brothers recommend, not doing guppies in a tank smaller than 20 gallons. I myself have kept them in, you know, over the years in anything from a gallon and a quarter to 55 gallons. And I would tend to agree that at least a 10 gallon is better. But it's possible to keep them in a smaller tank. It's just... You'll run into some issues with overpopulation, probably, and perhaps stunting and some things like that, and things to be aware of.
Will the ghost shrimp actually help with overpopulation, do you think?
That is a great question. About 10 years ago, I had a 10-gallon tank with guppies and ghost shrimp in it. There's a lot of Java moss, a lot of Java fern in there, so lots of hiding places. The guppies population increased despite the presence of the ghost shrimp.
So they didn't eat enough of them.
I don't know how many they were eating or whether they were eating them at all. I don't know. They may have been. But if they were, it wasn't enough to keep the population significantly down. And, of course, ghost shrimp, when you go to the pet store and buy ghost shrimp, there's a number of species you could be buying, and they probably vary in aggression and,
feeding
dietary
habits.
Needs to some extent. Most of them are opportunistic and they'll eat fish flesh if they can get it. And I do remember seeing them occasionally eating dead ones.
Well, you don't know if they were hunting them.
But I don't know that they were hunting them or not. So that's a good question. I mean, you could certainly try the experiment. I think I had about 6 to 8 ghost shrimp in the 10-gallon tank. And then I don't know how many guppies, number of them, always increasing. So, it could be worth a try, but it also depends on what kind of guppies you're getting too, if you have slower guppies like the fancy guppies, the shrimp are more likely to catch them, and also they're less hardy, and so they're more likely to be ailing. But that's another story, I guess.
Oh, and Tony has a PS. He says, thanks to the listener who mentioned the Something Fishy podcast. I have downloaded them all and I'm enjoying them immensely. Currently listening to the in-depth episode on betas. 70 plus varieties. Who knew?
Yeah, I'm going to have to download that one. Yeah. It sounds intriguing. I didn't know of its existence.
And then he has a PPS.
A post-post scriptum.
Yes, indeed. He says, Russ, Kelly, and Juliet. I wanted you to know that one of the Sounds Fishy podcasts includes a very in-depth discussion of dwarf shrimp and their breeding. The red cherry in particular receives the lion's share of the discussion. Juliet, I wonder if you might find some helpful hints on breeding. I, too, have been listening with interest. The one you want to listen to guest stars Rachel O'Leary. She is very knowledgeable. And he put up a link to that, so we can put that up.
We'll put it on the show page. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, thank you, Tony. I'll look forward to listening to that, too.
Alrighty, should we go to Matt?
Let's.
Okay, he says, G'day, Aquaramax. I am keen on participating in the Google Hangout live show, however I am not sure how that will work out given the time differences. Perth is about 8 hours ahead of GMT, which is Greenwich Mean Time, whereas in North America is between -5 in New York and -8 GMT in Los Angeles. I use these two cities as they seem to be at the extremes in time zones. I know you're in the middle somewhere. I think it's Utah. I'm not sure. That is -7 GMT. It is indeed Utah. So, and we are, we're an hour ahead of the West Coast, so it would be -7. So, for example, if it is 8 a.m. in Los Angeles or 11 a.m. in New York, it is 8 p.m. in Perth, Western Australia. To get the difference, you just add the two numbers together, making both numbers positive, so Utah would be 7 plus 8 equals 15 hours behind Perth. So 9 a.m. in Utah corresponds to 8 p.m. in Perth, Western Australia. If we did the recording on a weekend, that would solve this issue, or I could just send in another audio recording, whatever works.
And I responded briefly to Matt, but I think his idea of doing it on weekend is a good idea. Mm-hmm. Another possibility I was thinking of is, and I mentioned to Matt also, is we can find out how many people in that time zone where Matt is, or mm-hmm. close to Matt's time zone, close enough so that they could still participate. Find out how many people around the world in that time zone would be interested in doing one on a given day. Mm-hmm. And then we could just, you know, get a lot of people from those, from that time zone. That'd be good. So we'll look into that.
Yeah.
Good idea. I think to make sure we can include people, maybe we could say, you know, on this day, we're going to try to get people from this time band. And another day, you know, another month, whenever we do mm-hmm. them, we can say we're going to try to get people from this time band to make sure we can, you know, give everybody a chance who wants to contribute.
That would be good. Okay. So we're going to go to Scott.
Mm-hmm. Scott's in Texas.
Yes. And he says, I wrote you some time ago to ask your opinion on getting killifish for breeding. Well, much to my wife's dismay, I have added a new 5-gallon tank to our collection with two pairs of Fundulo Panchox Gardinieri. Gardinieri.
I think
I stuck an extra syllable in there.
That's okay. Gardinieri. I think Gardinieri is how most people say it, but...
Oh.
It's okay.
Okay.
You probably sounded closer... You sounded more Italian when you said it, so that's good.
They haven't yet spawned, but I suspect they will before long. So my question is this. Are there any foods you might recommend for the fry? I understand they are among the easier to spawn of the killies, but hope there might be foods I could use that I wouldn't have to culture. So here's his...
Let's talk about that first. No, that's his.
Oh, that is his. But I thought maybe that was you writing. That's a suggestion.
We need to respond to him first with this part. Okay, well, I haven't done much with killifish, so I'm not sure, but it seems to me that some of the killies like that are big enough that they can start taking things like, you know, Walter worms or vinegar eels when they first start out.
Oh, okay, so they're fairly big.
You do have to culture those, so that's a bit of a problem.
That's true, he wanted something he doesn't have to culture, huh?
Yeah, that's hard to...
Will they eat non-live food as fry?
Well, there are several issues with that. One is, a lot of the fish won't eat non-live food because the food's not moving, so it doesn't attract their interest. Mm-hmm. Others will eat it, but it won't do much because they need... actually the enzymes in live foods to get their digestive systems kicking. And others just, they'll eat it, but they don't do as well on it and things like that. So there are a lot of issues there. I mean, you could try something like Liquify, which I've used before.
What's that?
It's proprietary food that's a liquid that you add to the tank, and supposedly the fish eat it. I don't know if they do or not, but also infusoria in the tank tend to increase when you put that in, and then they eat the fish eat the infusoria.
I see. Could he? Well, he doesn't want to culture it, though. I was going to say he could start an infusoria culture.
Yeah.
Ahead of time, right. But he doesn't want to culture anything.
Now, we should have... I know that... Isn't this one of the species that Tony has recently bred? And what did he feed his? Seems like he put his in a Daphnia culture. And they ate some of the
wheel... He put the fry into the Daphnia culture?
I think so.
And they just ate the Daphnia.
And they ate the young Daphnia that we're just hatching.
Oh.
And if they're big enough to do that, then they would be big enough to eat, like, fairy shrimp. One of our listeners, this was a long time ago, a couple years ago, I think, said that when he was breeding his killifish... He would put fairy shrimp eggs in the aquarium, which is not the same as culturing because you're not having to do separate things outside of the tank. Mm-hmm. But he put the fairy shrimp eggs in the killifish tank. They would hatch out, and as soon as they did, the nauplai would be zipping around and the fish would eat those.
They would hatch in there?
Yeah.
You didn't have fairy to do
shrimp.
The fancy...
They're not brine shrimp.
Oh.
They're related to brine shrimp. I mean, brine shrimp are a type of fairy shrimp, really, but
okay.
They didn't need the salt, and so they were fine in the killifish water.
And they would just hatch in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would eat them.
And then they'd be ready to
in
eat. And then you put more in. So every 24 hours or so, he dumps more eggs in and go for it.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah. And I
then
don't
you,
know if
like you said, you
species.
Don't have to culture them. It's just like sprinkling in pellets or something.
Yeah. But then they hatch and go.
That's cool.
So I don't know. If Tony, you want to comment on that, the feasibility of that or other foods that you've used or anyone else who's been spawning killifish lately, especially killifish from this genus and... things that you've used that you don't have to culture. I don't think I've... Well, with the exception of live bears, I don't think I've ever raised anything that I haven't given live food to fish-wise. I mean, it's a baby, so that's hard to say. I take that back. In Hawaii, it's really hard to get hold of nematodes like microworms or Walter worms or anything like that legally. You can get brine shrimp easily, but you can't get some of the smaller stuff like that. And I had some longfin white clouds that I was spawning, and they were spawning like crazy in Hawaii, but they didn't survive very well because
I didn't
have foods like that to give them. And I gave them some of the Liquify,
mm-hmm.
and I remember I had this batch of like 25 fry that hatched out, and only one of them survived.
So the Liquify didn't do such a great job.
It didn't work so well. And then we took those same... fish, the same longfin white clouds, brought them back here. They spawned again within a very short time. They had spawned again. And I had microworms, and I gave the microworms, and boom.
And they were fine.
We had very low mortality and raised up lots of fry and sold lots of fry. So, there you go. Something to think about. All right, let's move to his next comment.
Okay, he says, so here's a suggestion and an opportunity for you guys to spend a lot of money. I don't know if you've ever set up a reef or a fowler system, F-O-W-L-R, but it would be kind of fun if you guys set one up and each week spent about 5 or 10 minutes talking about what you did to your new tank and what kind of research you did on equipment, reason for your purchase, decisions, etc.
Do you know what a fowler is?
No.
Fish only with live rock.
It's like not... corals and
not corals.
Oh, okay,
that's basically
okay.
What that means. Yeah, not you're not doing photosynthetic invertebrates.
Okay, so the lights are different.
Right,
lights are not nearly so expensive and intense.
Right.
Okay.
And the main thing is the fish, and you put live rock in there, and there are various hitchhikers and beneficial organisms in there, and maybe some naughty ones. But you're not focusing on growing the corals and the anemones and the clams and
I
that
see.
Sort of thing. Well, that does sound
fun. That would be fun.
I don't think we have a lot of money to spend right now, but that may
change
some time
in the future.
Nor
do we, unfortunately, have a place for any more tanks
right
now in this smaller spot.
Yeah, we're in a rather
cramped
place. But someday, I would love to do that. So let's do that when we can.
Okay.
When conditions permit. Because I love his idea of taking 5 or 10 minutes and talking about it,
mm-hmm.
and why we did what we did. Kind of like we did with the beta breeding project.
Yeah,
we did talk
about that.
Yeah. And we had... Carlos on, and we interviewed him on how to breed bettas, and then we talked through a little
mm-hmm.
update on each step, and so it'd be kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a good thing. So someday we should do that.
Yes,
it's a good idea.
Alrighty. And he does say he says the field recorder is working nicely, so
Good.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you, Scott. And let's go to Sean in Asheville, North Carolina. And he says, about the podcast volume, it's better. I was going to write to you about it, but someone else beat me to it. I really don't know audio, so don't have the lingo to communicate about it effectively. Anywho, I went from a BBC podcast to yours and didn't have to adjust the volume. Cool. That is cool.
Yeah. It seems nice. Like it's working better.
He says, I don't know if there's some published radio standard of how loud something should be, but it sounds like you nailed it. That's good. He says, by the way, you're probably up to the task, but if you need help setting up a Google Hangout event, let me know.
Cool.
So...
Well, I have done it a few times, but I may draw upon your wisdom there because it's been a while since I've done it. So
I have a question, all the way not related to fish, for Sean.
What?
Because he signs his podcast Cheers, and he's listening to a BBC podcast. So, Sean, are you actually from Great Britain somewhere? And you're living in North Carolina? That's my question.
Okay.
Okay. Had nothing to do with fish.
Okay. No, that's okay. Not everything has to do with fish. Oh, you know what? This next one I mislabeled.
Who didn't
actually label the top of it. It's Dr. Bob.
Okay.
North Shore, Boston.
Alrighty. And Dr. Bob says, and we're talking about the mycobacterium that he thought he had. I think that you were correct, Russ, about the mycobacterium being a pre-existing condition. I had noticed weeks before Dory died that his anal and caudal fins were tattered a little bit at the edges. I thought that it might just be a normal thing, but now I wonder if this was the first symptom, or is this a typical issue with betas?
Well, it could be both. I mean, it's not uncommon for betas after a while. It doesn't sound like he's saying that it blew it, though.
No, but they just get messy and tattered sometimes, especially if they have really long fins.
And as they're getting older,
they'll
tend to tatter a bit. But yeah, it's hard to tell. It could be related. Possible.
Or if he did have some kind of injury and that just lowered his whole immune system.
Yeah.
And then he says, fantastic show, love the talk on live food. One of these issues that I have, especially during the winter, is that I keep our house on the cool side. The high temperature morning and evening is 68 degrees Fahrenheit, and the low temperature afternoon and night is 62 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh my goodness, are you not freezing cold? I would be so sick all the time. Some rooms, like my bedroom, could be as low as 55. Oh, my goodness. That makes me cold just hearing that. That's like... We have our thermostat set to 70, and I never take my jacket off during the day. I'm wearing my jacket right now.
That's true. I can attest to that fact.
As you said, with my Enchitreus and now with the Drosophila, optimum temperatures should be in the mid-70s. That's not going to happen. So my search for food cultures continues.
Okay, well, here's something. If your bedroom is really that cool, you might want to consider getting white worms rather than grindleworms.
Do they like it cold?
They do.
Well, there you go.
And they do really well at cold temperatures and will grow like crazy. And they're very similar to grindleworms, except for larger. The only real difference is... practical from an aquarius standpoint, or that they need colder temperatures and that they are bigger.
There you
not
go.
Not a whole lot bigger, but bigger.
Not bigger enough that it would be problems for the fish.
No, they're about an inch long, I think. Grindleworms, the biggest grindleworm I've ever seen are about an inch long, and most of them are not nearly that big. He is feeding mostly his native fish tank with the black-banded sunfish and the darters and things like that.
How big are those? They're probably fine with
an
inch long worm. Yeah,
White worms would fit in their range of edibility.
So that could be a potential solution.
Right. And aquatic creatures like Daphnia and amphipods would do well at those temperatures as well.
Okay.
And I know he's pursuing getting some of those, but sometimes that can be more difficult than you might suppose. But he's working on it.
Alrighty. And he also says, the volume was good, but the balance was just a little off. I listened with headphones, so I might be too picky about balance. The right channel, Russ, was higher than the left, Kelly. Maybe a proximity issue?
I think we were both pretty close, because we were...
I wasn't talking as loud. I'm trying to talk louder this week, if it's different,
we discussed that to try to make sure we're talking loud and loudly enough, and I think the microphone might be slightly closer now, so we're working on the fine-tuning.
Yes.
We'll get there. But yes, thank you for letting us know about that. I really am glad we asked people to tell us, and quite a few people have mentioned.
Yeah,
things,
no, it's so good. It's good to get the feedback so we can make it better for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty, so thank you, Dr. Bob, and we've got Tom in Provo. He says, Russ Kelly and Aquarimaxers, I know that Diana Wahlstad presents data showing that at certain levels, lead is clearly harmful to fish, but I have not seen anything authoritative on plant weights as a source of lead in aquarium water. Many posters on fish forums assert that for one or more of the following reasons, plant weights are not a problem. 1. Plant weights are no longer made of lead. 2. Lead is not soluble enough to leach into the water at toxic levels. 3. The aquarist in question has had plant weights in their tank for years and never noticed any effect on the fish. I don't know if any of those assertions are correct, but it seems to me that with regular water changes, aquatic plants to absorb heavy metals, and a good water conditioner, levels of lead and the accompanying risk to fish should both remain very low even with metal weights. Could you comment on this issue? Have any listeners had fish problems convincingly linked to plant weights?
Okay. Well, this is my take on it, and I think I kind of go with what... I've done some looking into this for myself, and also after Tom's question, I looked into it a bit online to see what I could find. I did find a forum, and I'll try to put the link up to it, a forum thread where Diana Wahlstad was commenting on it, actually, mm-hmm. this very topic, saying that she would avoid putting metals in the aquarium in general. And as far as anything that looks like lead, I'm sort of paranoid about lead.
That's very true.
I really don't like to use it anywhere. Like,
he wants to put gloves on to hang the Christmas lights up. Well, so he doesn't have to touch them.
Actually, Christmas lights.
I mean, they are.
You know, the cords usually mm-hmm. contain a lot of lead.
I know, but you like...
It really bothers me.
Putting up Christmas lights stresses him out because he thinks we're all going to die.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but...
Only a little bit.
But I really... Lead bothers me a lot. So I wouldn't put... that kind of thing in my aquarium.
Well, you think about it, you wouldn't go dump it in a local pond either.
Right.
So if you were not going to put it in an outside pond, don't put it in your aquarium.
Now, something that he said is that the plant weights are no longer made of lead. I believe that is true in many cases. I don't know that it's universal, but...
Or if you get a hold of older plants from somebody who's had them for a while, or I don't know. Sometimes, you know, if you inherit a tank from somebody, it comes with equipment that's 20 years old.
Right. But the plant weights are usually, I've always considered them sort of disposable, that the pet stores use them as a little sink to the bottom, but then mm-hmm. once you get them in your tank, you either plant them or let them float, and you don't need the lead anymore.
Well, I thought he was talking about, like, fake plants.
No, he's talking about the real ones.
Oh, you mean...
There's these soft little strips
really?
That people wind around the bottom of the plants. Maybe you haven't seen
them. No, maybe I was thinking of I thought he meant, like, the fake plants when they have those little plastic...
Weights?
Trays down at the bottom. I figured there was some kind of weight that they stuck in there to hold them down, and I just never noticed them.
Okay. Well, no, usually they have... there are some weighted plant bases, but most of them just are plastic trays that you put gravel in.
You just put gravel in them.
Yeah.
Oh.
But in terms of... He's talking about live plants, and I'll show you next time we go to the local fish store. They usually have these little metal strips that they wrap around the base of the plant. They're quite soft.
Mm-hmm.
And... The idea is that they're heavy enough to make the plant sink, but they're wound softly enough around so they don't constrict like a rubber band might
and
damage
it.
The plant as much, okay. At least short term, but that you remove them once you get them into your tank and you get the plant rooted, you know, and then you don't need it anymore.
Oh, okay.
But I've heard all of these assertions that he cites, that they're no longer made of lead, that they use magnesium and or zinc for these... plant weights, that the lead's not soluble enough to leach into the water at a toxic level. I've heard that too, especially in alkaline water, that it doesn't dissolve that much. That I've also heard that it reacts to substances in the water and it produces, I guess it's an oxide on the outside of it that's much less soluble than normal pure lead is, and so it sort of protects it as long as the water is alkaline. And then lots of people will say, oh, I've had it, you know, for a mm-hmm. long time, and hasn't seemed to do anything to fish. So I think part of it may be what Tom cites, is that water changes and things like that can...
It doesn't stay in the water, even if it dissolves. It
reduces the problems. If water conditioners also, like he said, they precipitate heavy metals out of the water. So if you're doing a lot of water changes with that, you're probably minimizing any effect that they might have. And it's true, they've even used some aquarium plants, some plants that are kept in aquaria to remove lead from water. I think water lettuce is one of them. And their dry weight, if you put them in lead-laden water, they'll pull out huge amounts of it. And their dry weight, once you take the water out, a huge proportion of their dry weight can be lead. Crazy, wow. Huh? I think it was water
lettuce. Does it kill the plant?
Not that one. It probably damages some plants, but
wow.
I don't think it damages that one very much. So that I hope that kind of covers what I'm thinking. If any of you have had problems with the plant weights, though, please feel free to comment. I wonder how it would be if a snail chewed on it, if it would actually ingest enough of it, because it's pretty soft. If it's real lead, it's pretty soft, and even if it's not, those other ones are very soft. The plant weights that I've used are pretty soft, so I don't know if snails would eat it and if whether or not that would cause a problem. Or make it end up in the water column more, you know?
Because they've mangled it up into little bits. Because
they've been chewing it and excreting it in small particles. I don't know.
That's a very interesting question.
Changing the surface area, you know?
Oh! Okay. And he has a funny PS, too. He says, I googled Carnforth to confirm that there is not one in Texas. As far as I can see, Mix Carnforth is the only one in the entire world. So there we go. That is your Aquaramax geography lesson. There is no Carnforth in Texas. Okay. There's also no basement in the Alamo.
That's true. That's not one of those things you learn in school. It's just something
you have to experience.
Okay.
Okay, but you know what else this means? Is that now we doubly have to go visit Carnforth because it's the only one.
Right. It is unique in the world.
We need to take, an Aquaramax UK tour.
That would be cool.
With, you know, our extensive budget.
Yeah. Well, I think that's about it for now, so...
Wait, didn't you say Mick had something?
Oh, did I? Oh, I did.
Well, he's in the list,
Mick,
but he's...
Mick, he donated to the Aquaramax
fund. That's what the Mick thing was. Okay, yes. And the fact that he lives in the only Carnforth in the whole world.
In the whole world. Yes. That's true, too. Okay.
They could use that as, a community tourism slogan somehow.
Welcome to Carnforth. It's a unique town.
Yeah. The only one. The one and only Carnforth.
The only eponymous city.
Ooh, that's good.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen.
May the fish
be with you.